everybody.
Hi.
Welcome back to Nobody No Problem.
I'm Kristen.
Katie.
What's up, people? It's 2020.
Oh my God.
I know, we survived another decade.
Listen, my problem is we don't have flying cars and the driving cars suck.
This is
like
bullshit.
The self-driving cars suck.
Were they way too expensive for us to ever fucking afford?
My father pointed out that if we were relying on the Jetsons for any kind of clue of where we'd be at today, they really let us down.
They really let us down. They were like fucking living in the sky, dude.
I'm disappointed.
And I am too. Like those clear tube things that sucked you everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I want to go there.
Yeah, I want to buy the house next door and put in a McDonald's tube. Does that count for anything? Just my kitchen to yours.
Where we can just dig a hole underneath.
I don't want to
the
do
basement.
That work.
Well, it'd be like a fallout plan in case there's a serial
killer.
Yeah,
it would be cool. I want a tube.
Yeah, it would be pretty dope.
All right.
Just a clear hamster tube.
Yeah.
But anyway, we hope all of you had a lovely New Year's and brought it in with all of the people that you love and care about, drank lots of stuff, and got real drunk. We were up till 5 a.m., so we did.
Yep. That happened.
Dancing around as someone's a child. So today is episode 6.
Sace.
And we are going to be talking about, are you ready for this?
Nope.
The Sodder Children disappearance.
Sounds spooky.
It is spooky, but also I figured since you did one that was real intense last week.
Yeah.
Which
that
we
shit
hope you all
was
enjoyed.
Wild.
Real intense. This one is still very sad, but not as gory.
Sure. Well, I mean, it was straight up torture from a neighborhood.
Right.
So.
Entire fucking neighborhood.
Yeah.
Yeah. Real great. So, we're going to do that today. I'm pretty excited to talk about it because it is kind of a conspiracy theory thingy. So, I hope you guys enjoy it. So, we're going to start.
Yeah, you better make this good and worth my time.
It always is. So, we are going to start with me taking a drink. Give me one second.
Little drinky poop.
Little drinky poop. With George Sodder. He was born with the name Giorgio Sodder in Tula, Sardinia, Italy in 1895. He immigrated to the United States through Ellis Island. There he changed his name to George Sodder, I'm assuming just to kind of fit in with, you know.
Well, just to make it easier.
The Americans or whatever.
Yep.
He eventually found work on the railroads in Pennsylvania, carrying water and other supplies to workers. After a few years, he took a more permanent position in Smithers, West Virginia, as a driver. After a few more years, he started his own trucking company, at first hauling fill dirt to construction sites and then later hauling coal that was mined in the region. He then met Jenny Capriani, a storekeeper's daughter there, who would also come to the U.S. from Italy. I don't know why you feel that.
Italia.
Italia.
I want garlic bread.
Oh, I love garlic
Anytime,
bread.
Anytime anything somewhat related to Italy or Italian or food comes up, I want.
Garlic bread?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm in, just because it's bread.
All right, so they meet.
Right, so they meet. They're Italian and they love each other. And they eventually married. The couple settled outside Fayetteville, which had a large population of Italian immigrants, in a two-story timber-framed house north of town. In 1923, they had first of their 10 motherfucking children.
Yep.
So there's a lot of them, which is typical, I guess.
It's like a litter.
That's
a litter.
Dude, for real. They are Italian, though. So no offense to my Italian friends, but y'all have lots of kids.
Y'all know how to breed.
Y'all know how to breed is right. So they had Sylvia, Marion, John, George Jr., Maurice, Martha, Louis, Jenny, Betty, and Joe.
Jesus.
I know. There's
so many.
Say that
10 times fast.
For real. The youngest of whom, Sylvia, was born in 1943. So George actually started his own business doing similar work to what he was doing. So I guess he started his own like trucking company and they just like hauled stuff from the construction sites or whatever. And he was actually very successful. And they became one of the most respected families in the area.
Helps.
However, yeah, I know. It's always nice to hear people succeed. However, George wasn't everyone's cup of tea. cup of green tea. He had strong opinions about many subjects and was not shy about expressing them, in particular his strong opposition to the Italian dictator Benito Mussolini had led to some strong arguments with other members of the immigrant community. Some did not take them as well as others. So in October of 1945, a visiting life insurance salesman, after being turned away by George and his wife, warned George that, and I quote, his house would go up in smoke and your children are going to be destroyed. He attributed this to the dirty remarks he was making about Mussolini. So people are passionate.
Also, that's a death threat. Okay.
You literally just said, I'm going to kill all your kids and burn your house down. Hey,
by the way, your house is going to go up in smoke and your children will die. But have a great day.
Thanks for seeing me. So another visitor to the house who was seeking work took the occasion to go around the back and warn George that a pair of fuse boxes would cause a fire someday. Puzzled by the observation since he had just had his house rewired and it passed inspection. So, weird. And in the weeks before Christmas that year, his older son had noticed a strange car parked along the main highway through town, its occupants watching the younger Sutter children as they returned from school. Creepy. But all in all, the Sutters seemed like a normal family. I mean, they loved each other, and there's a lot of them, but they were...
A lot to love,
but they were, you know, cool with each other and whatnot.
All right.
So, the Sutters celebrated on Christmas Eve, 1945, as most loving families do. Marion, the oldest daughter, had been working at a dime store in downtown Fayetteville. She surprised her three younger sisters, Martha, Jenny, and Betty, with new toys she had bought them as gifts. The younger children were so excited, which is typical. They asked their mother if they could stay up past what would have been their usual bedtime. At 10 p.m., Jenny told them they could stay up a little later because, you know, I'm sure the kids were super amped.
Oh, it's Christmas Eve, too. Santa. That'd be something special.
Santa! I know him!
I don't. I've never met the man in my life.
Okay, so as long as the two older boys were still awake, completed their chores. So 14-year-old Maurice and 9-year-old Louis put the cows in and fed the chickens because that was their chores. So yeah. They were like, okay, Mom, and did their stuff because they were well-behaved Italian children. Her husband and the two oldest boys, John and George, who had spent the day working with their father, were already asleep. After Jenny said goodnight, she took Sylvia, who was 2 at the time, upstairs with her, and they went to bed. Jenny was awoken at 12:30 a.m. by the phone ringing. Jenny got up, went downstairs, and said, "What's up, bitch? Who's fucking calling my house at 12:30?
That's how I answer the phone every time. Send a text.
Serious. Well, it's 1945. So those don't exist.
Touche. But to be fair, that's how I answer the phone.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well.
All right, so she answers the phone.
Yes. She answers the phone. It was a woman whose voice she did not recognize, asking for a name she was not familiar with. And then you're like, bitch, who this be? With the sound of laughter and clinking glasses in the background, she told the caller she had reached a wrong number, later recalling the woman's weird laugh. She hung up and returned to bed. As she did, she noticed the lights were still on and the curtains were not drawn, because apparently curtains need to be drawn before you go to bed.
Why close all my blinds before I go to bed? It's got to be the same thing, right? You don't want peepers Do you want peepers looking through your windows?
I mean, my bedroom window is very high. So
okay, no, I'm not. I'm on the first floor.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah.
Don't tell people that.
I'm on the fifth floor.
That's what she meant. The fifth floor. Don't put that out there.
Sorry, typo.
So she hung up and returned to bed. So she noticed that the lights were out. Okay. She closed the curtains, turned off the lights, and returned to bed. At 1 a.m., Jenny was again awakened by the sound of an object hitting the house's roof with a loud bang, then a rolling noise. After hearing nothing further, she went back to sleep. After another half hour, she woke up again, smelling smoke. When she got up to see where it was coming from, she saw that part of the house was engulfed in motherfucking flames.
Jesus.
She screamed for George and her other children to wake up. Then woke up her two eldest boys and then screamed for the children asleep upstairs to get out of the house. So what I understand is they probably had a 2-story house, but there was an attic. Sure. So the kids, I believe, slept in the attic, which was like another layer. Yeah. Yeah. So it was like,
I guess, an extra bedroom.
Yeah. Or like I guess now that would make it like a 3-story house. So I'm sure there was like a stairway up to the attic.
No, they had to jump on a trampoline to get up.
Well,
there.
Sometimes you have that like pull down the string, you know what I mean?
Kidding. Yes, that's exactly what I imagined.
So both parents and 4 of their children, Marion, Sylvia, John, and George Jr., escaped the house. They frantically yelled to the children upstairs, but heard no response and could do nothing at this point, as in like returning upstairs because the stairs were now completely on fire.
Shit.
Well, that's what happens when you have an all timber motherfucking house.
Yep.
That shit's gonna burn. So they attempted multiple things to get to the kids. However, efforts to find aid and rescue the children were suddenly and unexpectedly complicated. Marion ran to a neighbor's home to call the fire department, naturally, as you do. However, well, I guess not anymore. We have cell phones. Well, who knows? You might leave your cell phone.
Well, I mean, 1945, yeah, that's what you do.
Yeah.
You run to your neighbor and call the fire department.
Call the fucking fire department. However, she was unsuccessful at getting through to an operator. So I guess back in the day, there was no 911 number. You had to contact an operator who would connect you to the fire station.
Yes, I do know that from listening to other murder podcasts, that 911 became a thing because of something.
Yeah.
Way more recently than I'd like to.
Really not that long ago that it became a thing. Late 70s, early 80s, if I'm not mistaken. But normally what happened. So they had to call an operator who would put you through to the fire station. Eventually, one of the neighbors was able to get through to notify the fire chief, who was found at a local tavern. In his defense, it's Christmas Eve, so. However, the fire department was low on manpower due to the war. So all the men were at the war and relying on individual firefighters to call each other. So that was another ordeal because you would have to call someone who would call someone who would call someone. So they basically had a phone tree.
Yeah.
So they did not respond until much later in the morning. The chief, F.J. Morris, who was the fire chief, said the next day that the already slow response was further hampered by his inability to drive the fire truck because he was hammered. Requiring that he wait until someone could drive was available.
I mean, don't drink and drive. That's
legit,
okay.
Legit, though. But unfortunately,
that meant
for the Sodder family, they were on their own. George then attempted to reach his children and was able to break open a window, cutting his arm very badly in the process. He called for the children, but heard no response. He and his sons attempted to use a ladder to get to the attic to rescue the other children, but it was not in its usual spot, resting against the house, and could not be found anywhere nearby. Fishy. A water barrel that could have been used to extinguish the fire was frozen solid. Not as fishy, because it was just cold as fuck, because it's West Virginia in December.
Yep.
George then tried to pull both of the trucks he used in his businesses, which I'm assuming are the giant work trucks, up to the house and use them to climb to the attic window, but neither of them would start despite having worked perfectly the previous day.
Suspicious?
Fishy fuck. The 6 Sodders who had escaped had no choice but to watch the house burn down and collapse over the next 45 minutes.
Well, that's awful.
They assumed the other 5 children had perished in the blaze. Isn't it, though? I couldn't imagine that.
Nope.
You really can't imagine.
Nope. No.
That's just horrible.
Awful.
Once the firefighters finally arrived, they could do little more than look through the ashes that were left in the Sodder's basement. By 10 a.m., I should probably mention. So the fire started around 2 a.m., 1:45, 2-ish. The fire department didn't get there until after 6 a.m.
Well, everyone was inebriated, mm-hmm. So.
So, and they lived 2 miles from the fire station. So just a little snippet on how awful that must have been. By 10 a.m., Morris, who is the fire chief, told the Sodders that they had not found any bones, as might have been expected if the other children had been in the house as it burned. Nevertheless, Morris believed that the 5 children had died in the fire, suggesting that it had been hot enough to burn their bodies completely. The chief told George Sodder to leave the site undisturbed so that the state fire marshal's office could conduct a more thorough investigation. Obviously, that makes sense.
Sure.
Since they didn't find anything, which I wonder how, good their search was to begin with if they're all fucking hammered and half asleep.
Did dude's like, look, I'm really fucking hungover. Can we get the state marshal to come in here and double check my work? Because I'm not 100%
I'm pretty
right
sure
now.
I'm still hammered from last night. So after 4 days, George Sauter and his wife could not bear the site anymore. So George bulldozed 5 feet of dirt over the site with the intention of converting it to a memorial garden for his lost children. I still don't know why you would ever do that. There's so much investigating that could have been done, but I mean, I guess I could never imagine.
Right. You don't know how he was feeling.
No, and I don't think anybody ever possibly can. Unless that's half of your family is gone.
Gone.
Just gone. The next day, the local coroner convened an inquest, or a coroner's jury, which is basically just a jury of people used to determine cause of death, and in this case, how the fire started, which they decided that the fire was an accident caused by faulty wiring. So that's basically just what a coroner's jury is they're used to determine like certain evidence and how people died, okay. Essentially. So death certificates for the 5 children were issued on December 30th. George and Jenny Sauter were too grief-stricken to attend the funeral on January 2nd, 1946, although their surviving children did. Not long afterward, as they began to rebuild their lives, the Sauters started to question all the official findings about the fire.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. They wondered why. It had been caused by an electrical problem. The family's Christmas lights had remained on throughout the fire's early stages.
So, like, they're outside watching their house burn down. They're like, well, at least the tree's still lit.
Yeah,
along
essentially.
With the rest of the house.
And then they were, well, if it was a fucking electrical fire, the lights wouldn't still be on.
Correct.
That should be out. So that's fishy. So they found the ladder that had been missing from the side of the house on the night of the fire at the bottom of an embankment 75 feet away. A telephone repairman told the Sauters that the house's phone line had not been burned in the fire as they had initially thought, but cut by someone, which is not an easy feat. It is a climb of 14 feet up a telephone pole, which, why? Why?
I like to cut my neighbor's phone lines.
Why? None of that makes any sense. So, a man whom neighbors had accused of stealing from the property around the time of the fire was identified and arrested. He admitted to the theft and claimed he had been the one who cut the phone line, thinking it was a power line, but denied having anything to do with the fire. However, no record identifying him exists, and why would he have wanted to cut any utility lines to the Sauter house has never been explained.
Hmm. I mean, totally normal.
It's like, well, oh, was it the telephone line? I totally meant to cut the power line. My bad. What?
Make the mistake all the time.
No one. I can't. So, Jenny Sauter said in 1968 that if he cut the power line, she and her husband, along with their other 4 children, would have never been able to make it out of the house. So, did he cut the phone line on a total accident, bro? Or?
But why is that?
I'm not really sure. Maybe because she was still up from the phone.
Ooh.
But also, this is my question, though. Because they said the phone line had been cut, but it had to have been after 12:30 because they received a phone call.
They got the phone call, but maybe she's saying that if they had absolutely no power of the house and she didn't wake up to the phone call at 12:30, she would have been in a deeper sleep.
Yeah.
And not smelled the smoke to get it.
And just been, because I'm sure
that
she was just awake.
That has to be it. What else would be the reason? It's
yeah.
Not like, I mean, do you, okay, this sounds really dumb. In 1945, do you have a smoke alarm system?
I don't know. I don't think so. I honestly don't think so.
Okay. So
maybe in like
what?
More up-to-date homes, but I don't think that they
in
had land.
In their timber homes?
Yeah, in their timber homes. They had land and cows and things like that. So there's a lot of weird moving parts to this story that don't really add up, and they add up to something really fishy. Because I still, that whole statement from this guy saying, well, I fucked up. I meant to cut the power line. But why?
I don't know. That doesn't make sense to me.
It doesn't, but who knows? Guy could have been fucking batshit. We don't know. So Jenny Sauter also had trouble accepting Morris's belief that all traces of the children's body had been burned completely in the fire. Many of the household appliances had been found still recognizable in the ash, along with fragments of the tin roof, which if your appliances, which I'm sure back then are like fucking cast iron and crazy huge can survive, there should still be bodies.
Right.
There should still be bodies. So she contrasted the results of the fire / findings of Morris with a newspaper account of a similar house fire that she read around the same time that killed a family of seven. Skeletal remains of all the victims were reported to have been found in that case. She then decided to conduct her own experiments and burn small piles of animal bones to see if they would completely be consumed. None ever were. Which,
damn.
Yeah, I mean, I was a mom who lost five kids. I'm sure she was pushing for anything at this point. And I feel like at this point, it's just, you need an explanation.
Correct.
So she also had contacted an employee of a local crematorium. And he told her that human bones remain even after bodies are burned at 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit for 2 hours. Far longer and hotter than a house fire could have been. Okay. So only human bones will remain. Sometimes they say that human teeth do, and some organs depending, but it's gross.
But I mean, so at a flame way hotter than the house burned, bones remain.
Yes. Correct. So I did a side note. The average house fire burns at 1,200 degrees Fahrenheit. The average retorter furnace is from 1,400 to 2,000 degrees and can take upwards of 3 hours to cremate a human body at that temperature. Even after this 3 hours, there are still dried bone fragments to be found. So the theory that the bodies were burned completely in the fire is just not scientifically possible. There would have been bodies. The fire itself lasted 45 minutes.
Okay. Yeah. No. Then that really doesn't make sense at all.
It doesn't. It does not. So the Sodders' truck failure to start was also considered. George Sodder believed they had been tampered with. This theory was never really looked into, but there was people saying that on the other side of things that they could have just been like in the craziness. They could have flooded the engines. But I don't understand how that would happen if you just try to start the car once.
Right, and then twice.
And they
had two cars and you did it twice.
They worked 12 hours ago. That doesn't really make sense to me. So there were also witnesses who have claimed to see the kids. So there was evidence that supported their belief that the fire had not started in the electrical system and was instead set deliberately. The driver of a bus that passed through Fayetteville late Christmas Eve said he had seen some people throwing balls of fire at the house.
Totally normal.
Why he didn't stop and do something or try and find someone to be like, this person's trying to burn down this house that is like a Christmas tree in it is beyond me.
Or excuse me, sir, can you stop trying to light this house on fire with balls of fire?
With balls that are lit on fire? I'd appreciate it. Thank you. So a few months later, when the snow had melted, Sylvia found a small, hard, dark green rubber ball-like object in the brush nearby. The brush. Why did I say brush? Whatever.
I don't know.
That was weird. George, who was a veteran, said it looked like a pineapple napalm ball, a hand grenade, or some other incendiary device used in combat. But we know that it definitely couldn't have been a hand grenade because everybody would have woken up. But
yes, and it couldn't have been just a regular pineapple because there are
Not flammable.
I eat that shit.
They are not usually on fire. Mm-mm, they are not.
If someone threw a pineapple at my house, I'd run outside and be like, thanks! Appreciate you.
Oh, I hate pineapple.
You know what? I don't like cutting it.
I just don't like it in general. I think it smells like absolute poopy.
You're weird.
Poopy. I am weird. But moving on. Well, I digress. One woman who had been watching the fire from the road said she had seen some of the children peering out of a passing car while the house was burning.
Well, okay.
I don't know, though.
That could be anything. But
yeah.
Add it to the list.
But I like, there's a lot of this stuff where I'm like, well, maybe this lady didn't know the kids. Because I was going to say, if it was a neighbor, but I read back and it wasn't, the neighbor would have been like, what the fuck?
It was just something that she was like, I read about this, and that night I noticed that there were little staring eyes at me out of a car.
Right. So another woman at a rest stop between Fayetteville and Charleston said she had served them breakfast the next morning after the fire and noted the presence of a car with Florida license plates in the rest stop's parking lot as well. The Sodders then hired a private investigator, C.C. Tinsley.
C.C. Tinsley, right?
Yeah, see? Oh, he's got the best name, too.
So, it's so good.
It's so good. To look into the case, he learned that the insurance salesman who had threatened them with the fire the year before over George's remarks about Mussolini had been on the coroner's jury that ruled the fire an accident and told this to the Sodders because they were unaware.
Don't be suspicious. Sorry, if you guys don't watch Parks and Rec, you won't get it.
Yeah,
but if you do, you'll
get it. But, like, that's super suspect.
Yeah.
Super suspect. Because, dude, who said your children will be destroyed? Like, that's intense shit.
Listen, I have never used that phrase in my life. And I get intense at work.
That is some, yeah, I know, right? That is some intense shit.
That's personal.
Not, I'm going to set your house on fire. Your children will be destroyed.
That's personal.
So, they found that shit out. Suspect, as we say. He also learned of rumors around Fayetteville that despite the fire marshal's report, he found no remains of the Sodder children. Morris had found a heart, which he later packed into a metal box and secretly buried it, which is fucking weird. So, Sodder and Tinsley, Sashay Tinsley, went to Morris and confronted him. With this news, he agreed to show the two where he had buried it, and they dug it up. They took what they had found inside the box to a funeral director, who, after examining it, told them it was really beef liver, very fresh, that had never been exposed to fire. Later, more rumors circulated around Fayetteville that Morris had afterwards admitted the box with the liver had indeed not come from the fire originally, or he had supposedly placed it there in the hope that the Sodders would find it and be satisfied that the missing children had indeed died in the fire.
All right. We could touch on this in so many ways, but let's just sum it up as, what the fuck were you doing?
Fucking C.F. Morris is a raging alcoholic psychopath.
I'm just gonna buy this beef liver, pass it off as a heart, and hope that this satisfies this grieving family. Why? And then he admits to putting it and burying it. So, like, why any of it?
Why?
It's a big question right there.
Like, I understand being like, maybe this will help him, but maybe he didn't have kids. Because if any parent would be like, well, I'm going to take this to someone to investigate it.
Well, clearly they've been investigating it. Also, so what did he think they were going to do?
Does not look like a human heart. Liver and hearts do not look anything like.
Listen, I watched Grey's Anatomy.
Me too.
I know that liver does not look like a heart.
No, livers are gross.
Oh, I've also recently heard that they're really gross to eat. So there's that.
Yeah, I'm not a fan.
I've also never eaten liver or heart.
I don't recommend either.
I don't know where gross. I got the idea to talk about eating them. But
well, beef liver. People eat it. Livers and onions, you know.
That's disgusting.
Especially back in the 40s, because that was a lot of people, you know, farms, and they just no waste.
You know what? I'm just going to go with hard no on all of it.
Yeah, I don't blame you.
Okay.
So, he also tried to interest the FBI in investigating what he considered a kidnapping. Director J. Edgar Hoover personally responded to his letters, which was nice. They basically said that the only way the FBI could get involved if the local authorities invited them, which still stands to this day, but the Fayetteville police and fire departments declined to do so. So they were just like, fuck you, fuck this shit, we out, we can do this, we got this. But they really weren't doing anything, and they clearly didn't have it.
Clearly.
So, in August of 1949, George was able to persuade Oscar Hunter, a Washington, D.C. pathologist, to supervise a new search through the dirt at the house site, the house burn site, whatever you want to call it.
Sure. I mean, the house isn't there anymore, but it is definitely the site of the fire.
Yeah, faux show. After a very thorough search, a few things were found, including a dictionary that had belonged to the children and some coins. Several small bone fragments were unearthed and were determined to have been human vertebrae. So the bones were covered, were then sent to Marshall T. Newman, a specialist at the Smithsonian Institute. They were confirmed to be lumbar vertebrae, all from the same person. He stated, since the transverse recesses are fused, the age of this individual at death should have been 16 or 17 years of age. Newman's report also said the top limit of age should be about 22, since the centra, which normally fuse at 23, are still unfused. Given this age range, it was not very likely that these bones were from any of the five missing children, since the oldest, Maurice, had been 14 at the time, and that's really not even close.
No, I mean, like, he's saying 16 to 17 in the top 22. Oldest one that was left in the house, so to speak, was 14?
Yeah.
I feel like they would be able to say, well, maybe there's a chance. I mean, they're fucking doctors.
Yeah, and he was like, there's no chance. So I'm sure he knew. He obviously knows more than we do about bones and what happens to them as you get old.
I've actually been studying bones on the side.
Well, it's actually kind of cool what they can do with them now, especially when it comes to moida.
I'm not saying it's not.
Moida.
I'm mostly making fun of myself because I know jack shit.
Yeah, I mean, I can't say that. I'm an expert. That picked up so hard. That's Cheers. A white claw. Cheers. Happy Friday, everybody. So Newman added the bones found showed no sign of exposure to fire either. So they definitely weren't in the fire. Further, he agreed that it was very strange that those bones were the only ones found, since a wood fire of such short duration should have left full skeletons of all the children behind. The report concluded that the vertebrae had instead most likely come from the dirt Sodder had bulldozed over the site, which is also fucking insane. Where did those come from?
Where did those come from?
Who do they belong to?
I don't know. I wasn't right? there.
No one knows. Literally nobody knows. So later, Tinsley, say Tinsley, supposedly
say
confirmed.
It so good. Can you say it one more time?
No, now I'm on the spot. I can't do it. You're
fine,
getting nervous.
But you're ruining my night.
Supposedly confirmed that the bone fragments had come from a cemetery in nearby Mount Hope, but could not explain why they had been taken from there or how they came to be at the fire site. The Smithsonian returned them to the Sodders in 1949. The current location of the bones is unknown.
Well, it's not like it not to be a bitch, but not that it matters, because we don't even know who the fuck they are.
But also, like, maybe it was a murder victim. Who the fuck knows at this point? And now they're just like, meh, who
well,
knows?
That's like another stone we do not feel like unturning.
No, no, no. That's a whole other wheel we gotta turn.
That's kind of fucked.
So the investigation and its findings attracted national attention, obviously. And the West Virginia legislature held two hearings on the case in 1950. And the case was officially closed. The FBI actually decided it had jurisdiction as a possible interstate kidnapping, which I was going to say to begin with, because they can't prove that the kids weren't taken across state lines, which then the FBI has complete jurisdiction and they can just do whatever the fuck they want. They can invite themselves in. I watch Criminal Minds.
I do too.
I love that show. But dropped the case after 2 years after following up on multiple leads that led nowhere. So they tried.
Okay, well,
props.
A for effort.
Right. With the end of official efforts to resolve the case, the Sodders did not give up hope. They had flyers printed up with the pictures of the children, offering a $10,000 reward, which is around $140,000 today, so a lot of freaking money, for information that would have settled the case for even one of them. In 1952, they put up a billboard at the site of the fire with the same information. I love that there's, like, pushing for it, but I feel like the second you start offering money, all the fucking crazies.
Yep.
All the crazies are just trying to, like, make something up that will get them somewhere. I don't know, man. I feel like
that's
that had to be really tough.
Yeah, that's the pros and cons of that situation.
Yeah, that's tough. Their efforts soon brought many more reported sightings of the children after the fire. Ida Crutchfield, a woman who ran a Charleston hotel, claimed to have seen the children approximately a week after the fire. She said, I do not remember the exact date. The children had come in around midnight with two men and two women, all of whom appeared to be of Italian descent. She attempted to speak with the children. One of the men looked at me in a hostile manner. He turned around and began talking rapidly in Italian. Immediately, the whole party stopped talking to me. She recalled that they had left the hotel early the next morning. Investigators today, however, do not consider her story credible, as she had only seen photos of the children 2 years after the fire and 5 years before she... It was 5 years before she came forward. So, but still, you never know, dude. Well, you never don't. Really know. You don't. So there were also a few more leads from all over the country. George Sauter followed up with leads in person, traveling to areas from where tips had come. A woman in St. Louis claimed Martha had been held in a covenant there. A bar patron in Texas claimed to have overheard two people making incriminating statements about a fire that happened on Christmas Eve in West Virginia some years before. None of those proved significant, however, when George heard later that a relative of Jenny's in Florida had children that looked similar to his. The relative had to prove the children was their own, and George was finally satisfied, which is nuts. But I also...
I get it.
I couldn't. That poor man. In 1967, Sauter went to the Houston area to investigate another tip, because he drove all over the fucking country. All over. Everywhere. To find his babies. That's just... ugh, it breaks your heart. A woman there had written to the family saying that Louis Sauter had revealed his true identity to her one night after having too much to drink. She believed that he and Maurice were both living in Texas somewhere. Police were able to find the two men, so them, who she indicated, but they denied being the missing sons. Family said that years later, that doubts about the denial linger in Sauter's mind for the rest of his life.
Aww.
I know. So he really thought that it was them. In 1968, more than 20 years after the fire, Jeannie went to get the mail and found an envelope addressed only to her. The letter was postmarked Central City, Kentucky, with no return address. Inside was a picture of a young man around 30 with features strongly resembling Lewis's, who would have been in his 30s if he had survived. On the back was written, Louis Sauter, I love brother Frankie, little boys, A90132 or 35. Whatever the fuck that means.
Yeah, no idea.
And they studied this and had experts look at it, but no one had any idea
what it would have meant.
Nope.
Okay.
They hired another private detective to go to Central City, Kentucky, and look into the letter, but he never reported back to the Sauters, as they were unable to locate him afterwards. The picture, nonetheless, gave them hope. They added it to the billboard as well, leaving Central City out of it and any other published information about out of fear that Lewis might come to harm, and put an enlargement of it over their fireplace. Sad face. George died in 1969, not knowing what happened to his babies.
That's just, ugh.
I know. Jenny and her surviving children continued to seek answers, and their questions about the missing children's fate. After George's death, Jenny stayed in the family home, putting up fencing around it and adding additional rooms for the rest of her life. She wore black in mourning and tended the garden site of the former house for the rest of her life after her death in 1989, the family finally took the weathered, worn billboard down.
So it was up for...
1952 to 1989.
Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Valiant effort.
Yeah, and all she wore was black for the last, like, 30 years of her life. That was the only color she wore. I know. Ugh, it's so sad. So, the surviving Sauter children, joined by their own children, continued to publicize the case and investigate leads. They, along with the older Fayetteville residents, have theorized that the Sicilian Mafia was trying to extort money from George Sauter, and the children may have been taken by someone who knew about the planned arson and said they would be safe if they left the house. They were possibly taken back to Italy. If the children had survived all those years and were aware that their parents and siblings had survived too, the family believes they may have avoided contact in order to keep them from harm, which makes sense. Because fucking the other private investigator that they hired disappeared.
Yep. Yeah.
Literally disappeared. And it's not like they gave him enough money for him to run to Mexico and start a new life.
Right.
Not even close.
Yeah. No. If someone were to have kidnapped me and were like, if you make contact, we will kill the rest of your family, I would simply just have to never talk to my family again.
Yeah. I mean,
that's just what it is.
Yeah. And I feel like that's the Sicilian Mafia ain't something you want to fuck with.
Nope. And if they're listening, we have no problems with you.
We don't.
We're not trying to stir up any... Don't kill us.
Please. So as of 2015, Sylvia Sauter Paxton, now 69, is the youngest in the family and is the only one left... And is the only one left of the surviving children, thank you, who were in the house on the night of the fire, which she says in her earliest memory, is her earliest memory, I was the last one of the kids to leave home, she recalled to the Gazette Mail in 2013. She and her father often stayed up late talking about what might have happened. I experienced their grief for a long time. She still believes that her siblings survived that night and quietly assists with efforts to find them and publicize the case. Sylvia's daughter said in 2006, she promised my grandparents she wouldn't let the story die and that she would do everything she could. No breaks and no new evidence have ever been discovered.
Fuck.
I know.
I mean.
There was a lot of moving parts to that, so I hope you guys enjoyed it because there's a lot. That happened. That's real fucking weird.
It's weird.
It is. And there's stuff that's... The phone line, when I read that, I was
so
like...
So many suspicious things.
Well, and the napalm thing, which...
I think my biggest thing, personally, is the lack of skeletal remains.
Yeah. Where did they go? There's no way that they...
Zombies.
Right? That's happening. But we also... there was the night of, they were like, we were screaming for them. I mean, there's articles about where they like give statements and they say we were screaming for them and screaming for them and screaming for them and no one was answering because no one was there. Someone would have heard something and woken up someone.
Well, even at some point, I mean, question is, do you know if there were windows in the attic?
I'm assuming,
at some point, wouldn't you have just fucking jumped out and said, well, this is better than burning alive?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, I know they were young, but there was a few that were old enough to understand what was happening.
Well, it seems like the ones that were upstairs were all old enough to understand an emergency of a fire.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, no, I just...
Shit's fucked.
It's crazy, man. It's a crazy story. I read about it and was like... Because the holidays, I was like, Christmas Eve, I feel like it's appropriate. But it's also fucking nuts.
I mean, nothing we talk about is appropriate.
Right,
but with
correct.
The holiday,
wrong
yes.
word. It was coinciding with the holiday? Oh, yeah. I will do sources. So my sources were Wikipedia, SmithsonianMag.org, and Dark Matter's YouTube channel, which is great. And I love Kaylee, and I listen to her stuff all the time.
Shout out, Kaylee. Dope. Shout out, dude.
You're awesome. I love your stuff. But yeah, I mean, it was a crazy story. And there are different renderings of what exactly happened, but I feel like I researched enough to get a relatively good grasp on the basic stuff as, like, you know, the story.
Yeah. I mean, that was nuts.
Yeah, it was good.
I hope everyone enjoys part of our new equipment tonight.
Oh, yeah. We got new mics and we got preamps and things because apparently we think we're podcasters.
Listen, fake it till you make it.
Exactly what we're doing. Rewear, you should go. Man, I wish we would have videotaped what we were doing before this. It was hilarious. We were just a little bit unknowing, I guess.
We're ignorant on mm-hmm. this subject matter, but we're becoming acquainted.
Yeah, so we hope the sound quality is just a little bit better because we did get new mics. So.
For sure. But we're not going to bore you with that.
No.
We'll be excited by ourselves.
Like, subscribe, and review. Yes, please review us. I know that they won't all be good, but we need constructive criticism, so we appreciate the time.
Seriously. I mean, if you have anything to say, you can post on one of the social media platforms or send us a message.
Oh, for
or
real.
If you personally know us, send a text.
Oh, yeah. We've got a few. We love. Thanks, Emily. Yeah. You're very sweet.
Thank you, babe.
So, and follow us at nobody.noproblem on Insta and nobody.noproblem on Facebook.
Yep.
Like, subscribe, and follow.
Review.
Well, and follow, because you would follow us on Instagram.
Don't follow us in real life, though. I heard about this show called You. I don't want my friends to be killed. So.
Oh, man, did you watch it?
I've never watched it. Oh, I don't want to even go into that.
Joe's a crazy motherfucker.
Whatever, he looks good. Mm-hmm. All right, so on that note, we will end on a joke.
Katie's Horny Corner.
Sure. Hey, Kristen. Why can't you run through a campsite?
Well, I don't know, Katie. Why can't I?
You have to run because it's past tense. I can't. You're welcome.
We hope that made you think as well as laugh out loud because it's great.
Or made you hate me. Whatever works best for you.
But, yes, on that note, we are going to peace the F out.
Yeah, I'm Katie.
And I'm Kristen, and we are Nobody No Problem.
See you next week.
And catch you on the flip side.